On today's episode, Liz and I welcome Jessa Zimmerman to the show, and we have a great discussion about all kinds of questions related to sex and stress, from discrepancies in sexual desire and understanding the difference between proactive and reactive desire to the sexual avoidance cycle. Jessa shares all kinds of information to help you and your partner create a stronger marriage connection. Jessa Zimmerman is a certified sex therapist and couples counselor. She specializes in helping couples who have a good relationship but who are avoiding sex because it's become stressful, negative, disappointing, or pressured. She educates, coaches, and supports people as they go through her four-pillar experiential process that allows them real-world practice in changing their relationship and their sex life, guiding them to become easily intimate. She's the author of Sex Without Stress, the host of the Better Sex podcast, the creator of the Intimacy with Ease method, and is a regularly featured expert in the media, including Refinery29, Business Insider, MindBodyGreen, and Marriage.com. We hope you enjoy the show. Hey friends, welcome back to another episode of the Stronger Marriage Connection. We're glad you're here with us. I'm Dr. Dave here at Utah State University alongside Dr. Liz Hale, our licensed clinical psychologist and family marriage therapist. We're bringing you the best we have in research, in resources, and tips and tools to help you create the marriage of your dreams. All right. Well, it may be no surprise that one of the topics couples argue about most that creates disconnection is... Liz, sexual intimacy.
Indeed.
It is a stressful issue, right? That is difficult for many couples to discuss. Well, today we're going to focus and we're going to tackle all kinds of questions about sexual intimacy with a certified sex therapist from Seattle, Washington. Welcome to the Stronger Marriage Connection podcast, Jessa Zimmerman.
Thank you for having me. Happy to be here.
So glad that you're taking time to be with us today. Let's start things off a little bit about you and your background and why you jumped into this area as a sex therapist.
Well, I was getting my master's to become a therapist, and I knew going in I wanted to work with couples, you know, which is all I do, actually. But early in that training, a sex therapist was there teaching this little weekend sort of mini class, and she said that she considered sex therapy to be mostly grief and loss work. And something about that like hit me like a lightning bolt. Like people are suffering when they are not connecting sexually with their partner. There is grief and loss around that. And it was just like one of those moments, you know, that you have occasionally in life. It's like, that's what I'm going to do. So I had to, you know, finish my master's program and go through all the training and process to get certified. But that was my goal from that time. And that's all I do at this point.
Wow. Yeah. And I'm sure you stay busy with
yeah.
that.
Yeah, I do.
I looked into that when I was in Seattle as well with you, and there was a lot to it. I ended up not taking the whole enchilada, going that whole course, Jenna, but I'm so glad that you did, Jessa. Excuse me. I'm so happy that you did. And thank you for being able to really let us in on what we need to better understand about sexual intimacy. And the good thing is if couples are talking about it, right, that's really where the beginning stages, the good part is if we can keep talking.
Yeah, it is. It does tend to be a topic that can be hard for people to talk about. A lot of people were raised never talking about sex. It was sort of taboo. And I don't know that our culture supports that very well. So, you know, sometimes people come in and see me and they've been struggling for decades. And this is the first time they've said it out loud. I mean, like they both know it's been a problem, but it's been such a struggle to address it.
They don't know what to do, right? They don't know where to start. I think there are fewer issues that are as disappointing, I think, and frustrating, and pressure-filled than the sexual desire. And this whole discrepancy, how common is desire discrepancy, Jessa?
Well, here's the thing. It's universal. It's inevitable that at least over time, there's going to be a difference in desire, because why would any two people want sex the same amount, right? So it's actually... every couple has desire discrepancy. It's just, it doesn't always cause a problem. And that's important to understand when people are struggling with this. They think that their differences in desire are the problem, but it's really how they're handling it.
It's my interpretation of my husband's lack of desire, right?
Yeah, exactly. What do we make it mean? Or, you know, where we go with that and the cycle people can get into around it, make it a problem.
Mm-hmm. I'm curious then, what makes it become such a problem for some couples?
Well, there's sort of what I call the traps of desire discrepancy. So the first thing people need to understand is the lower desire person. Well, first of all, this desire discrepancy is relative. It pertains to any two people in their position relative to each other. So it's not like somebody has high desire and somebody has low desire. It's about how you are in relation to your partner. So somebody might have been the higher desire partner earlier and now they're the lower one. Or in a different relationship, they were the higher one. Now they're the lower one. So it's just important to understand it's relative. But one of the facts about this is a lower desire person has the control. And that is not because they want it. They generally do not want this. But because they want something less, they're the one saying yes or no or if or when, right? And that feels like a lot of pressure. It can feel to the higher desire person like they are being controlled. Or the partner is withholding on purpose or something. And we have to understand that, you know, they sort of have their hand on the spigot. And again, not because they want to. And there's pressure inherent in this difference. You know, so one of the traps is waiting for the pressure to go away. You know, once the pressure comes off, then we can deal with this. But that's going to be a problem because there's always pressure when somebody wants something more than the other person. And one of the biggest traps, too, is taking this personally. This happens all the time. The higher desire person tends to take this personally. So they feel rejected. They feel, you know, they wonder if their partner doesn't find them attractive anymore or desirable anymore, or, you know, they're not important enough or whatever. But that's meaning or an interpretation we don't have to make. It's much more helpful to see it as this is just where your partner's at and how their desire works. And it's not about you. Because what that does, if a higher desire person takes this personally and they feel rejected and they get mopey or grumpy, you know, my seven dwarves that we started using when they don't get sex, it changes the meaning of sex. Now, the lower desire person is supposed to have sex so their partner feels okay about themselves. You know, or doesn't get grumpy or something. So now it's not about connecting with this person. It's about trying to avoid these consequences.
And then that doesn't feel good to the high desire person, right? It's like, you're just having sex with me, right? Yeah, I had to beg for it.
Exactly. It doesn't feel good to either one when it starts to be like, this is something I need to do, some sort of obligation, right? And it gets harder and harder to do and to enjoy.
So is the whole premise then, Jessa, to get the low desire to have a higher desire?
Well, it's not quite that simple. It's about changing even what you think of as sex, or, you know, understanding that sex is about pleasure and connection. So we kind of have to broaden our idea of what even counts and what is this for. So people go in very goal oriented. We're supposed to do this certain thing for a certain outcome. And that's going to be problematic. That adds a lot of pressure. It's also, though, about unlocking what I call reactive desire. So there's two ways of feeling sex drive. One I call proactive. You know, that's on your mind. You're thinking about it. You're in the mood. You'd like to do this thing. And that's what we think of as libido, right? But reactive drive is where you're not thinking about sex. You're not in the mood. But if you started and you got what you needed, maybe your body responds. Maybe you end up aroused, you know, and it's like, now I want sex. So I do think it is about accessing that kind of reactive drive and helping that emerge, combined with the sort of flexibility around what, you know, sort of what are we even doing here? What counts?
Mm-hmm. I think that's beautiful. Just one more question, if you don't mind, yeah. Dave. And Jessa. Yeah. So what about aging? Does aging change the desire?
Yeah. So I think.
Is that a myth?
No, it's not. It's not really a myth. It's not universal for every single person. But I think the older we get, the more we tend towards more reactive desire. Now, this isn't universal, but for a lot of people, they sort of swing that direction. Also, the longer we're in the relationship with the same person. You know, the brain chemistry is different in the beginning. Right? Everything lights up for the first 18 months. There can be a lot more proactive desire at that point. And when your brain chemistry switches over, a lot of people move more towards reactive desire. You know, stress, other obligations, kids, all kinds of other stuff, too. Basically, anytime someone is not in the mood for sex, they might be able to get in the mood. You know, if they created that opportunity and if we approach that right without a lot of pressure.
That's so encouraging. Thank you for that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm curious then, I like this topic, the tips. Do you have tips for those, you know, high desire or things that they shouldn't do and maybe even shouldn't, you know, say or do? It's going to create problems and this keeps the cycle going.
Well, yeah, let me think about this because I recorded a whole little video about it, but let me see if I can pull them all to mind. Like, first of all, thinking that, so if I'm speaking to the higher desire person, thinking that your partner is broken and something is wrong is going to be a major problem. The lower desire person, by the time they come to see me, often feels broken. They feel like I'm missing something. I'm inadequate. It's all on me. It's a lot of pressure. And that is not an empowered place to deal with this. And it doesn't help if the higher desire person also just thinks they're broken. So we have to sort of change our thinking about this. So any language you've got around what's wrong with you, you should go see a therapist, you should go see a doctor, you should fix this thing, is going to be problematic. Focusing only on your own pain and longing is going to be a problem. Because if you go to your partner saying, I don't think you realize how important this is to me, it's going to reinforce this idea that they're letting you down, which is also going to pile on the story that they're broken. So while that pain is legitimate, you know, that you might miss this sexual connection with your partner, you kind of got to go in thinking, what has this been like for them? They probably do feel broken and guilty and inadequate. And so having a lot of compassion for what's gotten in their way of their sex life will be helpful. And then the sort of all or nothing goal orientation around sex is also going to be a problem. We have to do a certain thing, a certain way to a certain endpoint, and trying to be more flexible around that. Like, hey, it all counts. Can we just be, you know, physical together and see where it goes and really embrace that is really, really important.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah. Great, great tips. Cause I know, yeah, that's an issue for many couples, probably at all ages and stages of, yes, of relationships. So that's very helpful. Jessa, I think another question that has come in from our listeners, and I'm hoping you can tackle this one, is they talk about painful sex, you know, understanding painful sex and what they should do. Where do they start with that? Because for some couple, it could be just very stressful. And I don't want to tell them. I don't want to say anything. This is embarrassing. So thoughts, recommendations for those experiencing pain?
Yeah. So this is really, really important. Sex should not hurt. So first of all, an awful lot of people come to me and it's hurt all along and they just thought that's the way it was supposed to be. It shouldn't hurt. And there are so many things that can cause pain. I mean, I think we're specifically talking about women having pain with sex. There are a lot of different things that can cause this, and it can be really hard to get at the root of it. You know, there's a wonderful book called When Sex Hurts that sort of goes over all the different kinds of things that can cause pain. And one of the first things that authors say is that it takes an average of 6 or 7 doctors to get an actual accurate diagnosis about what it's even going on. And you might be surprised to know this, but an awful lot of even gynecologists and urologists are not very well trained in sexual health, which is, you know, it's like, aren't those the doctors we should see? But, you know,
you think so, right?
Yeah. So you have to be really persistent with seeking an answer to what's going on. For an awful lot of people, it's also very helpful to go see a pelvic floor physical therapist, which is a very, you know, it's a specialty. People with very specific training and working with learning to relax the pelvic floor muscles, because sometimes that's causing the pain. And sometimes that's a symptom, like that's a response to pain from other sources. But fundamentally, besides, you know, seek the medical route, figure out what's going on and treat that. Most pain is treatable. In the meantime, do not do things that hurt. It's counterproductive to like, grit your teeth and get through it and tolerate it. You know, that's just going to make it harder. And it's such a deterrent to wanting sex, and it's going to make your body sort of clench up more and more. It's counterproductive. So while you're pursuing the answer to the pain, just explore everything else that you could possibly do that is pleasurable together. You know, so that's a role of sex therapy in this equation. What can we do in the meantime with the parts we've got that are working and are enjoyable? Like, let's make that as great as possible while hopefully you're figuring out the pain on the back end.
Yeah.
Let's work with the parts that aren't hurting.
That's exactly. Yeah. Right. I mean, you know, we got to shake things up and figure out what's possible here.
We'll be right back after this brief message. And we're back. Well, let's dive right in.
You talk also just about a sexual avoidance cycle. Tell us more about that, please.
Yeah, this is something when I wrote my book in 2018, I started with this because I see it all the time with couples. So when sex doesn't go well, air quotes here, because I don't think it can go badly, but when it doesn't meet your expectations and you have experiences that, you know, or dissatisfying somehow, or you feel like you've something's wrong or whatever, you have negative feelings about that, right? I mean, at least disappointment, but maybe feeling broken or inadequate or worried or what does this mean for our relationship or ashamed or whatever it is. And then it's human nature to avoid it. You know, it's human nature to avoid the things that make us feel bad. So if there is some chance that you're going to come out feeling worse or confronting, there we go again, where my partner's disappointed or whatever, it's natural to avoid it. But avoiding it, of course, doesn't make anything better. And what it does is it actually increases the pressure on your sex life. So if you're avoiding sex, there's this pressure that, first of all, we should be having sex and we're not, or my partner wants sex and we're not. But there's also more pressure on any sex you have. Like if you have sex a lot, you know, whatever that is for you, it's like one time doesn't go well, no big deal. We do it again Tuesday, or, you know, like it, not a big deal. But when it's infrequent, there's like that much more pressure that this time better go well. We don't do it that often. This has to work, or this has to sort of disprove this fear I've got that something's wrong. But if you think about it, like, how are you supposed to have a nice time and like relax and enjoy each other under that kind of pressure? It's really difficult. So you're more likely to have another experience that kind of lets you down. So that's why it's a cycle, because, okay, you know, you get caught in that.
So it's best to stop avoiding. Am I understanding you? And utilize the parts that do work. The worst thing, it sounds like, would be avoiding.
Avoiding is a problem. But even before that, it's about, let's address the expectations that are setting you up to think like you're failing in the first place. Like, that's where it really all goes wrong, is thinking that any of these experiences are a problem, instead of realizing anything can happen. It doesn't matter. It's just about pleasure and connection. Like, it's all our thoughts about what should be happening, what we should be feeling, and how it should be going, and what we should be doing. Those are the problem.
Excellent. I don't know that I've heard a sex therapist really talk this way. Just, no? I mean, it's really, it's quite refreshing. Not often. It's more about the functioning, right? And the problem, if it's not happening, and what we need to do about it. But just the relief of watching my thinking about this topic is beautiful.
Well, and I guess in my experience, like, there are sexual dysfunctions. There can be things going wrong that affect how your body works in sex. And there are some things we can do about that sometimes. But more important to me is, like, let's not need that. You know, let's see all the options first. And often by taking off that pressure, it's amazing. Things work better. I mean, so much of this is mental in the first place. Not everything. Some of this is medical and physical for sure. But there's a huge mental component to it too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And man, I mean, this topic we're talking about, Jess, is, it's, I mean, very serious, right? It could be very stressful for couples. The title of our podcast, Stronger Marriage Connection, and this can create disconnection about as fast as anything that we know. What do you suggest then? Let's say, you know, one partner says, I just don't like sex anymore. You know what? To be honest, I could go the rest of our married life and not have sex and I would be just fine. And that maybe is devastating for another partner to hear. Do you have a story or an example where people are just not on the same page? They're really struggling, but they were able to turn it around, or how do they do that?
Yeah. I mean, I have endless stories. And I'm laughing because I can't tell you how many times I've heard that exact thing. If it were up to me, I could go my whole life without sex and be just fine if it just weren't for my partner, right? The fact that I care about them. I hear it all the time. So yeah, I mean, I've got endless stories about this, but basically the issue here is the person who says this is not feeling any proactive desire, and that's normal. So it's really about, how do we access some reactive desire and figure out what would actually be pleasurable in touch for them? And so much of this has happened because they think, oh, we have to have like intercourse, for instance. It's got to be a very particular thing. And it's yes or no. We're either having sex or you're not having sex. So trying to shake this up. I mean, the metaphor I use is that sex is like we're going to the playground. It's the outing that counts. it's not what we do when we go. We don't know ahead of time what we're going to feel like doing on the playground. We don't know how long we're going to stay. If we just go, that's a win. And so trying to shake, you know, take all that pressure off and then explore what would be enjoyable now. And for a lot of people, I mean, one of the couples I'm thinking about, sex worked pretty well for them for a long time until she went through menopause. And then sex was painful and her desire did really change, right? So there almost no proactive desire at all anymore. There was such an, you know, they had equated for so long that sex was intercourse, that when that became difficult, it seemed like, well, now we just can't have sex. So thinking about it differently and giving yourself permission to think, to explore what would I actually like now, which is probably very different than when we got together at 25 or whatever, and just treating it like this is just about pleasure and connection. Let's not have this goal orientation that's in the way. I mean, they just like embraced this. It was like permission to be like, oh, it doesn't have to be this thing we always thought it was. And both of them, you know, enjoyed showing up and connecting physically again. And she found some reactive desire. Like sometimes she did want sex.
Mm-hmm. And you've used those terms. Do you mind just sharing with our listeners, what is proactive desire? What's reactive desire?
Yeah. So proactive desire is, I think what we think of as sex drive and libido. So that's when it's on our mind. We're in the mood. Okay. So maybe already aroused or interested. And that's what I think, that's what we see in the media and the movies and all this stuff, right? Mm-hmm. That's what we think we're supposed to feel. Reactive desire is the kind that comes out after you start. So you're starting at zero. The engine is cold. You are not interested in sex per se. But if you are willing to engage and willing to explore touch and willing to start somewhere different, potentially slower, and you get what you need, maybe your body wakes up. And then desire might come out. But the thing that's so important to understand is reactive desire shows up somewhere between 5% of the time and 95%. It is not 100. So this is where this all or nothing thinking can be so problematic, because somebody who's starting at zero, if they feel like, oh, if I start this, I have to finish it, they're going to start saying no a lot, because they only say yes when they're sure they can do the whole thing. Reactive desire needs maybe, because they can't tell ahead of time if I'm going to end up interested or not, right? It has to be that if this doesn't turn into sex, that's got to be okay.
Yeah. Oh, man, it's so important for couples to realize that it almost takes, you know, work. It just doesn't all of a sudden, hey, I'm just in the mood all of a sudden. That yes, it the mood comes after the fact. And just realizing that, I think, for a lot of couples, it's like, oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, again, the same people who have said to me, I could go my whole life without sex and I'd be just fine. When I describe reactive desire to them, they tend to say, well, yeah, that happens. Like it doesn't count or something, but this is normal and common and a totally valid way of experiencing desire. It's totally normal, but you have to approach it differently.
Mm-hmm. Hmm. Yeah. Love that.
Do you have any other thoughts, Jessa, about approaching this differently to make it enjoyable and connecting? And so it sounds like may or may not end in intercourse, and that's really okay.
Yeah. So it's about really embracing this concept of the playground. I mean, you don't have to use that metaphor, but that's the one that this is about pleasure and connection. It is not about any particular goal or outcome. You've got to be willing to reinvent things. You've got to be willing to start slower. You've also got to be willing to think that two different people might want something different out of the experience. So one person who feels a lot of desire might really want sexual pleasure, and the other person, if their sexual desire doesn't show up, they still might enjoy physical intimacy of some sort. So instead of thinking, oh, it's got to look this certain way and we both want the same thing, you know, trying to make that way more flexible.
Yeah. This could really deepen intimacy between a couple, can't it?
Yeah.
Maybe even more so than if they were on the same page with desire. The fact that you have a high desire and a low desire, it really forces you to speak from your heart. It's very vulnerable.
Yeah. You know, it's funny because you would think sex is really intimate, but it isn't always. And if two people, when everything's kind of working and they just sort of do what they do and they've got, I mean, a lot of people, they've got the way they have sex, there's this rut, they don't even have to necessarily be that present. You know, so it isn't necessarily intimate just because of what you're doing with your bodies. And when people have to kind of confront this thing and reinvent and connect with, what do I actually want? And I have to be able to ask for that. And we've got to go in not knowing. It's like you're really way more present. And I think way more intimate, even if it doesn't necessarily go well or work that easily at first.
That is really the good news, isn't it? Desire discrepancy. If we will utilize your advice.
Yeah, I've had an awful lot of people tell me, I mean, they come in with these things that seem so problematic and so scary and so heavy, and they leave like, what a gift this challenge was, because we had to reinvent. I mean, you know, because it was all fine while it was working, except they didn't even realize what they were missing. And somehow this challenge that they've had has been like this opportunity to really reconnect at a deeper level.
Yeah, I feel a relief just as a marriage and family therapist having you in this discussion. So thank you so much. You have all kinds of great resources to help individuals and couples, online courses, podcast, blog. Tell us a bit about what you offer and where you'd like listeners, where they could best find you.
I have an awful lot of stuff. So I would tell people to go to intimacywithease.com. Everything is on there, but I would draw people's attention to a few different things. One is I have a free little webinar masterclass about how to make sex easy and fun for both people. So you can sign up for that there. I also just at the beginning of this year released two what are called secret podcasts, one for a higher desire person, one for a lower desire person. They're each just 6 episodes that you can sign up for and have access to for a week. And they really address each side of this coin. So I think that any of those would be useful for people.
That is very cool. So some is for the higher desire and others are for the low desire.
Yeah. One little secret. Yeah. One is for the higher, specifically speaking to them. And the other one is for the lower, because it really is a different experience. I mean, they go together. They're two sides of the coin, but they're very different experiences. So, yeah.
I love it.
So great.
Nice.
And it was intimacy with ease.
Right.
Is that right?
Yes.
Okay. And we will put all of those resources in our show notes, friends, so you can go and check out all these amazing resources that Jessa Zimmerman has put together for you. Jessa, before we let you go, a couple of questions for you. One is, we like to ask all of our guests, what do you feel is the key to a stronger marriage connection?
I actually think it's honesty. Being willing and able to talk about anything, the difficult stuff that, you know, because if you can't talk about what's bothering you or your fears or what's coming up for you, that creates disconnection. There's a barrier there. So the ability to be honest, even when it is a hard topic or even when it isn't what your partner wants to hear, even though you might have some stuff to work through, I think is the real key to connection.
Yeah, man, so true. And for so many people, it's just, I'd rather not bring it up. And avoid that. And then years and years and years go by and then resentment builds and all this cycle that we've talked about.
Yeah.
I love that. Great honesty. What's your takeaway of the day? What do you want our listeners to remember from our discussion today?
I think if I were going to distill it down, it's that I truly believe that you can't fail in sex. If you really can change this paradigm, you're in a position where you're really just thinking about this as pleasure and connection, we're not attached to anything else, you cannot fail. There is a way that this can just be easy and fun. It may look different than you wished it did or the way it used to or whatever, but if you can embrace that, the sky's the limit.
Fantastic. Thank you. Liz, what about you? What's your takeaway of the day with our conversation with Jessa?
Just so similar to what Jessa just said, that sex is like going to a playground. We don't know how long we're going to stay. We're not sure what we're going to enjoy once we get there, but we are going to enjoy it. So it's not about the outcome or the goal.
Yeah.
Dave, what about you? What's your takeaway from our time with Jessa?
I love thinking about this. Now, just my wife and I, we just celebrated 25 years of marriage this past August. And I could just really relate to that. That proactive and reactive types of mood. It feels like, early on, it's like, hey, always in the mood. And then as time goes by, it feels like you have to move into the mood, if that makes sense. You move, you transition. It's not, I'm not in the mood. If you only had sex when you were in the mood, you might not have sex for some couples. So moving into that and then thinking, okay, now my body is catching up and everything is being released in the, you know, the dopamine and the serotonin, all that's released. So I love that concept of that reactive, proactive. So thank you. Thanks for sharing that. That's wonderful insights today. So, well, Jessa, man, we sure appreciate you taking time to come on and share so many awesome insights. And I think just very helpful, practical things for our listeners to tune into. So thank you for joining us today.
You're welcome.
All right, friends, that does it for now for us for another episode of Stronger Marriage Connection. We'll see you next time.
And remember, it's the small and simple changes that create a stronger marriage connection. Bye-bye now.
Thanks for joining us today. Hey, do us a favor and take a few minutes to subscribe to our podcast and the Utah Marriage Commission YouTube channel, where you can watch this and every episode of the show. When you hit the like button and leave a comment, your feedback helps us improve the show. And don't forget to share this episode with a friend. You can also follow and connect with us on Instagram at Stronger Marriage Life and on Facebook at Stronger Marriage. Be sure to share with us what topics you want us to cover and what you loved about today's episode. If you want even more resources to improve your relationship connection, visit our website at strongermarriage.org, where you'll find free workshops, webinars, relationship surveys, and more. Each episode of Stronger Marriage Connection is hosted and sponsored by the Utah Marriage Commission at Utah State University. And finally, a big thanks to our producers Rex Polanis and Alexis Alcock and the team at Utah State University. And you, our audience, you make this show possible.